Yes, hello. Is this machine recording? I'm Jason Louvre, and this is the Ultra Culture podcast, back as promised. So my guest for this week's episode is John Graham, who is the acquisitions editor at Inner Traditions Publishing Company and is actually my editor and was the person who was brave enough and willing to take on my new book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels, for publication. So I've known John for probably 7 or 8 years now, and we've had a great working relationship. And I look to him as somebody who knows just a tremendous amount about the subject matter of the esoteric and of Western esotericism in general. I mean, he's been living and breathing this, you know, since for a long time and in a professional capacity since before I was even, full-time interested in the occult. So he has just a tremendous backlog of, you know, information and wisdom and insight on the subject matter of the esoteric. And I thought it would be great to sit down to do a podcast with him to talk about even just a tiny slice, you know, a tiny segment of his knowledge and information on this subject. So we kept our discussion somewhat constrained to at least just the Western esoteric tradition, and particularly John Dee, so that the podcast would be related to the new book. But we got into some pretty exciting territory. The podcast starts off, you know, we're a little bit in the historical weeds in the sense that it's two guys who are very interested in historical minutiae talking about the Western esoteric tradition. But stay with it because the conversation really spirals out from there into the broad, full spectrum, not only of the Western tradition as it was, but as it is now. We talk about kind of the occult war between the left and the right that's going on right now. We talk about, Trump and, you know, the Julius Evola and the traditionalist school and the rise of the alt-right and meme magic even we get into, and all of the kind of background occult conflict that's been going on in the last couple of years in the world at large. So it was a fascinating conversation and provides a lot of context on some of the background moves that have been happening. We also just talk about, you know, life in general as a magical practice and a magical process, and some of John's experiences in that regard. And I think you'll find this very, very fascinating. So it occurred to me that, you know, for the intro to this show, some of my friends who do podcasts, like Zach Leary, for instance, and Duncan Trussell, I've noticed they open up their podcasts with kind of general intros, where they use it as a platform also to talk about what's on their mind outside of just the context of the interview and give a general update to their listeners on what they're thinking and where they're at, kind of similar to blogging. And I feel like that's a great idea. And as long as the listeners are interested in that, then I'm going to try that out and use it as a little bit of a place to have a one-to-one conversation with you every week. Of course, if everyone decides they hate this feature, then let me know and I won't. But in the meantime, why not? So since this episode really got into politics and the politics of the left and the right, it occurred to me that it might be really good to just say a few things about my political position and how it has, I won't say evolved, but has contextualized itself over the last few years. So as you know, if you've been following my work, you know that before I started working on this book, which again was a three-year process and pretty all-consuming, you know, I was blogging, you know, fairly consistently 2 to 3 times a day at Ultra Culture, and I was focused totally on political issues and the things going on in the background of the mainstream narrative about politics, and also working, you know, as a journalist at Vice News and Boing Boing, and doing things like breaking the story of the TPP, which then became a major, you know, issue in the 2016 election, talking about oil pipelines, things like that. And my political position before the Trump phenomena happened is fairly well documented because I was writing about these things all the time. But I really spent the time of the 2016 election and the buildup and the dawn of the alt-right and all of this stuff pretty much sitting on the sidelines without directly getting engaged in it because I had a book contract. And as I say in this interview with John, who provided me with that book contract, it really was a godsend in a way because it allowed me to kind of get a little bit of distance on that battle, and in a way that some friends that I have, journalists who are involved in it, did not get distance and just got chewed up by it. One of the things about being a journalist is that you're exposed to traumatic things on a regular basis, whether that's war footage or, watching the dissolution of the Republic. These things, of course, news consumers are exposed to also, but not at the same saturation generally as journalists, unless they're news junkies. And journalists can be somewhat traumatized by that, without having any training for how to deal with that. That's a lot more pronounced for embedded journalists who are actually in war zones, but it's also actually true for journalists who are just being exposed to that footage on a regular basis. So it's actually not a light thing, even though it sounds easy to dismiss. It's actually not. So here we are on the other side of the election, and I won't say the dust has settled because we are in a full-scale, red alert emergency situation. But I also have noticed that the public discourse, the public commons, if you will, is very much wrapped around the fight between the left and the right, particularly at the cultural level. So, for instance, we have mainstream bloggers and mainstream commenters at places like New York Times and The Guardian who are maintaining more or less the party line. And then we have, as the New York Times has just so cringily named it, the intellectual dark web. So we have people like Joe Rogan and Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson and people that particularly much more people are listening to, I think. And there has been a resurgence of essentially old Bush era neoconservatism in the case of people like Sam Harris or Jordan Peterson, now masquerading as rebellious. And then, of course, the alt-right, which has been deplatformed in the last few months. So, during the Obama administration, my overwhelming frustration was that the real issues, as I see them, that being primarily the environment, really first and foremost, but then things like the reality of global poverty and real existential risks, whether that's the threat of nuclear war or nano or bio war, or even perhaps the proliferation of a rogue AI, which becomes more likely as time goes on, it seems. These, for me, are the real issues, primarily the environment, because it's the one that's the closest to the average individual. My personal view is that the environment, we really, it's quite likely that the biosphere, as we know it, will not survive the end of the century. And if the biosphere collapses, meaning not just the rainforest, but the coral reefs and the various animal species, for instance, bees and frogs and now mammals, and certainly amphibians, things like that, the various species that make up the health of the biosphere and the scaffolding of the network of life on this planet, which we don't fully understand, the more of that stuff is destroyed, and in many cases irreversibly destroyed, the less support there is for human life. And so we're in a position where if the nature that supports us is gone, which in itself is a tremendous, incalculable tragedy, then it's quite likely that the human species also will not survive because there won't be anything there to support it. You can't eat phone apps. You know, you can't eat, well, you can't eat GMO food, but even that may be trickier and trickier to mass produce. So for me, this is the real issue. The fact that humanity seems to be hurtling at faster and faster speeds towards a wall. Now, prior to the Trump phenomena, it seemed to me that mainstream liberalism and the Democratic Party in the U.S. were shockingly unconcerned with this and much more willing to play cultural level battles, and that my goal with the Ultraculture blog when it was running full time was to cut through that and make people more aware of things, even like the NSA scandal, also drone warfare, things like this, not in a conspiratorial way, but in a real way, simply in the sense that the mainstream media almost always chooses the cultural news and the cultural war between the left and right as a team sport over the truly frightening news, the real news. Now, that really hasn't changed post-election, and now Trump occupies the headlines in the mainstream media, and the mainstream media will simply report nonstop on whatever Trump just tweeted and whatever outrage that Trump has manufactured that day, very often as a way to manipulate the media into paying attention to him. And the media has bought into this almost 100% in that Trump is one of the greatest things that's happened to the mainstream media. He's increased newspaper circulation. He's increased mainstream media viewership. He's like the villain in wrestling that you love to hate. And while that dog and pony show goes on in the background, the Republicans and corporate concerns and people like the Koch brothers are doing everything they can to dismantle our, not just our civil rights and our civil liberties, but whatever remains of the protections of the environment, starting with, for instance, Trump selling off of public lands to withdrawing from environmental protocols and so on and so forth. And this, for me, is a tragedy that extends far beyond the single person of Donald Trump. He is just the most visible. He's just a distraction, in my opinion. He really is. And the fact that the left and the right continue to play, contact football instead of focusing on the real issues, which is the survival of the species, is, as dark-sided as it gets, in my opinion. It's a tremendous failure and abdication of responsibility, not just to the American public, but to the human species as a whole. So why do I bring this up? I bring it up because as I come back to doing the podcast on a regular basis, and of course, as I've been doing lots more public interviews, I find myself easing back into the public commons and the public debate. And I feel that it's important as I do that to leave a marker right now as to what my position is. And my position has not changed in the last decade, and that's simply that I'm concerned with the survival of the human species and the survival of the biosphere as a whole. And so I have to come to that, the fury that I had at the ruling establishment when Obama was president is, now, of course, I think that Trump is a far, far worse president by far than Obama. I had my issues with Obama, but Trump is a whole other deal. That said, my fury is the same in that, now that the right is at the helm, it's simply right-wing cultural issues and the fight over identity politics and the academy with people like Jordan Peterson and things like that is still a tremendous distraction. The issue is the survival of the species. And as long as we're in this left-right sport, which is really kind of the great sport of American life, more than football. It's whose team is up, you know, the left or the right, and the great debate over whose values should prevail. Well, when the clock is ticking on whether the human race will survive at all, in my opinion, focusing on these issues is not only trivial, but criminal. So this is my political position. It's the, in my opinion, the political position that is most ethical and most moral to hold and maintain at this time in history, which is that while all of these issues are important, that if there's no species left to fight over them, then what's the point? You know, my political position is we can fight out our differences and our cultural issues after we've ensured the fact that we'll still be alive at all, right? And the survival of the biosphere is the preservation of the game board, right? If the world is a chess game, or, you know, any type of game, you know, chess game is perhaps too Manichaean, but if the world is a game, then the only moral position in my view is not to continue to support one side or the other, or, you know, there are many sides, whatever 64 sides you want to pick. It's to work to make sure the game board stays so that the game can continue. The game must continue. We can return to picking sides once we have ensured that the security of the game board. Okay, so I leave that there simply to think out loud and to define where I'm coming from, particularly because the political landscape has become so contentious and bloody and gloves off and, you know, take no prisoners in the last 2 years, that I re-enter it with some trepidation and simply wish to define where I'm coming from as I do that. But that may be useful perhaps to you to hear also, whether you agree with it or not. Perhaps it's useful for you as a data point with which to begin to think about your own position. Okay, so that's my intro for this week. The importance of the environment and the survival of the environment and the human species as a whole, which of course is driving all of these issues of resource scarcity that and population that are manifesting as, you know, battles over border security and things like that, as people begin to realize the direness of the situation and perhaps begin to reach for not particularly useful strategies like xenophobia and closing down and trying to preserve their tiny part of the world, instead of working with humanity as a whole to fix the underlying issues. Okay, so all that said, we're going to get into the interview with John. I think you'll really enjoy this. And of course, please follow me on Twitter at Jason Louvre. Keep an eye out. If you haven't already, definitely pick up my new book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels. It's currently, I think, $10 off on Amazon. So it's an amazing deal. And if you aren't already, check out the free course on magic, the mailing list, which you can get simply by texting the word shaman to the phone number 44222. Okay, looking forward to introducing this episode to you, bringing this episode to you, and I will see you next week for another one. And it's great to be back in touch, by the way. Oh, and by the way, I just wanted to add one quick thing. At one point in this show, John mentions a pope in relation to Columbus, and he emailed me to inform me that he'd gotten the name of the pope wrong and wanted to correct that. So the pope is Innocent VIII, for those who are keeping track. All right, on with the show. John, what's up?
Well, I've been busy reading manuscripts. Saw one today on Rosicrucian influences, William Penn, which I hadn't really seen much on before. So,
who was William Penn?
The Quaker.
He's the founder of the Quakers.
Well, he was the one that was had to leave England. I don't know if he was really the founder of the Quaker, or just a major thinker, but was being treated as a heretic in England and moved to the United States. He's the founder of Philadelphia and the Pennsylvania colony.
So does that mean there's a Rosicrucian influence on the founding of Philadelphia?
Yep. Yeah, the there's a similar occult city planning at work in Philadelphia, apparently, as Masons used for Washington, D.C.
Wow. So when I first started, actually, I think when I pitched the John Dee book to you, you had urged me to look at Francis Bacon and the New Atlantis and the whole kind of Rosicrucian idea, the Rosicrucian ideas behind founding America. And then so on the last podcast, I also talked to Mitch Horowitz, who of course has written a ton of stuff about the occult roots of America. And it's actually something that I don't know a whole ton about. Mm-hmm. So, but what I kind of brought out in the book was that, you know, all the foundational math, the thinking behind creating America that came out of the Rosicrucians and went into the Masons and the founding fathers of America, and all of the thinking of Francis Bacon in founding America, you know, the ideals of European Rosicrucianism were kind of concretized and came into their full form as America. And I'm wondering if maybe you can fill us in on more of the history behind that.
Well, the term Ben Salem is from Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. I think he mentioned it in the D book. And that is a part of Philadelphia that William Penn laid out. There's also Pietists. That was another esoteric group that used to have retreats and temples, so to speak, in what's now Fairmount Park in the city of Philadelphia, along the Wissahickon Creek, which apparently was once known as the Ganges of the Rosicrucians.
Wow. What was so, meaning the sacred river?
Right. Right.
And what was so special about that river?
Well, just that's along that river is where they had their temples, their meeting places. And at the same time, there were other sects moving into the colonies at that time. The Moravians, who were also linked with the sex magic practices of William Blake a century later. So,
wow. So not to go too much on a tangent, but this is something that I don't know a whole ton about either. There was all this like sex magic with William Blake, and then there was kind of like this early history of sex magic with Patchell Beverly Randolph and all these people mm-hmm. around this time in the U.S. practicing sex magic stuff. And this was before Crowley and before the OTO, right?
Yeah, it was before the OTO. The OTO codified it for, I'd say, a modern audience. Or not modern anymore, but at the time, you know, they were, like most esoteric groups, they're drawing from a variety of groups that preceded them. And sometimes they fudged a little on the lineage, acting as if they were direct descendants of this or that group. But one could say it was more a chosen inheritance rather than, you know, genealogical bond.
So who were these sex magical groups at this time, and what were the practices they were doing? And just to tie this in, sex magic comes out of the Rosicrucians, is that correct? Or often just kind of ends up with Rosicrucian motifs?
I wouldn't say that it's a fundamental part of Rosicrucian practice, but a lot of subgroups of Rosicrucian that adopted Rosicrucian ideas, say like the Moravians that were associated with William Blake. And it, you can find things that are similar to the actions that the angels imposed on Dee and Kelly.
So meaning the wife swapping between Dee and Kelly. Well. So where was that popping up?
Well, we have a book on the, we bought it actually from was published in England, and we bought the American rights. And in England, it was called Why Mrs. Blake Cried, because she was not a willing participant in her husband's practices and swappings and so forth.
Oh, so they were partying.
Yeah. So he was. I can't remember our exact title. It was like the sexual, spiritual sexuality of William Blake or something of that nature.
Yeah, I remember we reviewed it for Ultra Culture, but it wasn't me that wrote the article. So what were William Blake's practices then?
Well, I was saying that it's not so much practices as a free sex that was counter to the monogamous traditions of Protestant England at that time. Wasn't exactly like a series of things that one could equate with tantric practices or OTO practices.
Was it more about kind of taboo breaking?
Yeah, I would think so. And also sex used as a way of inducing binary experimentation.
Interesting.
I think the title we gave it was William Blake's Sexual Path to Spiritual Vision.
Okay. Wow. So, yeah, I think I'm almost not sure where to start with this, because in assessing the Hermetic, Rosicrucian, Masonic tradition, of which John Dee is so clearly a central figure, it's such a tangle of different groups and lineages and belief structures, all of which are kind of under the umbrella of Hermeticism, but it's not like Hermeticism is a single ideology. But clearly, we can take Dee as a central figure, and I've tried to piece that history back together in this book. But also, we can see the Rosicrucians, we can see, like sex magical practices, like clearly popping up and becoming a central thread. But I'm wondering if maybe you can shed light on, I think you're probably one of the best placed people in the world to give a good overview of Hermeticism, having worked publishing Hermetic material and interacted with so many people. And, I know you've spent a lot of time traveling in Europe and kind of interfacing with perhaps the occult world over there as well. So I'm really curious what your take on what Hermeticism is from your perspective. I know it's a big topic, right? So.
Yeah, that's kind of a open-ended question.
Well, maybe let's start with the parts that relate to Dee specifically and his impact on Hermeticism and how you see his ideas kind of carrying forward into the continent and then maybe into America and shedding some more light on how his ideas ended up shaping kind of the early foundation of America, because I touch on that a little bit in the book. But it's a huge topic, right?
Oh yeah. Well, it all comes back to the New Jerusalem and how the apocalyptic scenario is going to play out. In Dee's case, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. In Dee's case, as you know, the apocalypse was a necessary step to purging the corrupt Christian structure of its elements that were had been made corrupt by the fall. The angels were looking to purify man, and man was resisting that, hence their anger, hence their ill treatment of Dee. So you find this New Jerusalem concept in the Templars. Columbus apparently was also intrigued by this notion that he'd allegedly been given by his possible real father who was Pope Leo.
Columbus's real father was Pope Leo.
Yeah. That's, oh. I mean, that's one of the, that he was a bastard son of Pope Leo.
Wow. Where did that information come from?
That's a, there's an Italian author that has studied Columbus and has presented evidence for that theory. Pope Leo was looking to fulfill the Templars' dream to found the New Jerusalem. Columbus was to be his agent. He was poisoned by the Borgia Pope that replaced him. So, who was also the one that was involved with Ferdinand and Isabella, who actually used money they stole from the Jews and the Moors in the final conquest of Spain to fund Columbus's expedition. But I think it was said the of the desire to create a utopian community that would embody all of the positive elements of Christianity and was more predicated on establishing a quicker route to the wealth of the Indies.
And so that was the new Jerusalem.
Yeah, that was an ongoing theme you find that crops up in European Hermeticism and in the New World was interpreted as being the land provided by God in order to build this utopian community free from the corruption that had prevented its creation in Europe.
Huh. So I know that when Dee was interested in this topic, and then of course Bacon and the Rosicrucians, when they wanted to establish their New Jerusalem, you know, their view largely, in my understanding, was that the corruption was the Catholic Church. But you're saying that even this idea cropped up in Catholicism as well.
Yeah, well, the history of the Borgia Pope, the Vatican at that time, which was one of the incentives for Luther and others to make a break from the corruption of the Catholic Church. I mean, there were also people within the Catholic Church that were trying to, you know, eliminate its more mundane, corrupt elements, but they didn't succeed. The Borgias were powerful.
Hmm. So one of the things that really, you know, that came out of my, you know, I really dialed in on the research for this book was, and I'm about to ask you a slightly controversial question, but what was that there was such a open war between, you know, both Protestant and Catholic sides at this time, and that the Hermetic tradition was very much part of that war, and that there were all these subgroups and sub-factions fighting it, but that there was, you know, as William Burroughs would have put it, an open metamagical war between the Catholic and the Protestant blocks, and that, you know, the central prize of that war was this New Jerusalem. It was who was going to get control of the New World, and therefore kind of the economic edge in the European game. So something that I've been thinking about recently, and this is a controversial question, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on this, is I started to wonder if this war ever actually ended, and if there actually is kind of an ongoing perhaps a magical war, you might argue, between kind of at least nominally Protestant and Catholic groups, and things like the Jesuits and the Rosicrucians and the Masons and things like this. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I wouldn't reject it out of hand. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the idea that the 30 Years' War, which was emblematic for the ongoing contention between Catholics and Protestants and virtually destroyed Germany, was said by some to have started as a Rosicrucian-inspired war when Frederick, the Elector Palatinate, went to Bohemia to become king of Bohemia after the death of Emperor Rudolf, which did not was not agreeable to Ferdinand, who was the Habsburgs. And after a year's war that ended with the Battle of White Mountain, Frederick was sent packing, and Rudolf's Prague, which was the high point of Hermetic culture at that time, was returned to kind of, you know, Catholic Puritanism. And one could say that, I mean, I don't have direct evidence that there are different magic groups. Gary Lachman's new book that hasn't been released yet on the 4chan magic.
Yeah, I have that sitting right here. I'm going to have him on the show.
Allegedly, but, you know, help. I mean, they claim they got Trump elected through meme magic. I mean, it's certainly possible, but in any case, the people with the real magical power aren't advertising it.
Right. I guess I'm thinking more in terms of perhaps the Jesuits or the Vatican, or, you know, more about the control of.
If you look at the real, you know, the real history of the Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt, his main motive was to destroy the Jesuit order. It was a war between the Illuminati and the Jesuits. Hmm. And in that struggle, Weishaupt kept absorbing Masonic lodges throughout Germany. At one point, a disgruntled ex-Illuminati spilled the beans about his plans to the wife of the Elector of Bavaria, who then cleaned house. And Weishaupt ended his life in exile. And it was only after the French Revolution that Abbé Borel and others who could not comprehend the idea of a revolution occurring from the ground up, but it always has to be imposed by some master individuals behind the scenes, blamed it all on the Illuminati. I mean, they looked at how effectively the Illuminati had managed to insinuate their people in the court system, the educational system, even the elector's own court, until he removed them all from power. But they claimed that the French Revolution was created by the Illuminati, who had performed, who had insinuated themselves in similar fashion in the French Convention and in the court of Louis the 16th and so forth.
Huh.
So that's a common theme. It's just like George Soros has been made, you know, the architect of everything that the right doesn't like that the left is doing. I think George Soros is just a convenient, you know, it's projection, it's perception. The right needs a leftist scapegoat to draw attention away from the very real money bags that are supporting right-wing causes like
right,
the Koch brothers.
Right, right, right. Yeah, nobody ever brings up the Koch brothers when they're talking about George Soros.
But, you know, there isn't a book out there like Jane Mayer's Dark Money that totally illustrates what the Koch brothers and the Mercers and others like them are doing. It's like the solid research. There's no book out there that says George Soros, that can show that George Soros is performing a similar bankrolling of the left. It just isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, I think multiple times in my life, I've worked in shared offices with MoveOn, and they're like the most underfunded, perpetually stressed, you know,
Right.
It's just like a few like kids out of college who are trying to make a difference and are just, you know, it's not like there's tremendous funding there, and they're driving around in limousines trying to overthrow state power or something like that. It's quite the opposite. But it's interesting that you mentioned the Illuminati and the French Revolution, and then in the context of 4chan and meme magic and things like that, because, you know, it's in a way that whole meme magic thing has kind of been, it's almost like the, how do I put it? It's kind of like deep underneath that, it seems like the traditionalist school of magic just kind of decloaked all of a sudden. And, you know, a lot of the esoteric thinking that was going into that stuff was coming out of Julius Evola and Ganon and Spengler and people like that. And when you really dig in to, you know, the right wing view of reality, a lot of them are, including Steve Bannon, it seem very resentful about the French Revolution. You know, Rene Ganon picks up on that theme a lot. And they are really, you know, still saying, look, we need to turn back society to before the Enlightenment, before the French Revolution, get rid of the idea of egalitarianism and that everyone is equal. And that this is disastrous to the, I guess, the hierarchical way of seeing society that Ganon and Evola were so big on. So it's interesting that you bring up the Illuminati as kind of a scapegoat in that way, and George Soros as a scapegoat in that way, because, you know, at least my read of things is there seems to at least right now be an open magical war between the left and right of the occult, with the left being personified by philosophies perhaps like Crowley's Every Man and Woman is a Star, the idea that everyone is equal, that enlightenment should be free for everyone, which is in high contrast to perhaps Julius Evola's way of viewing the world, which is that, you know, the occult should be reserved for elites that control society. And I guess on one hand, I'm curious, yeah, if we can trace this stuff back directly to things like the Illuminati that you're talking about, or the kind of battles for, you know, the soul of Europe that were happening during the Renaissance and the 30 Years' War. And I think one of the reasons that I wrote the D book is to kind of bring that, you know, cast some light on our current moment and, you know, hold it up as a mirror to what's going on right now. But I'm wondering if we can trace some of this stuff back directly, even, which is kind of what I was getting at when I was asking about, you know, is there perhaps an ongoing occult war that has never ended?
I can't really say that I've seen evidence of it.
I guess when I talk about occult war, I'm not thinking, like, a lot of times it's not as much like direct conflict between individuals as much as what ideas are achieving primacy in the culture. And, you know, clearly in the last 2-3 years, there's just been this tremendous shift to the right, and, you know, the right wing becoming so much more dominant in the counterculture discourse. And usually when I see massive shifts like that, I just automatically assume that some group of people is agitating behind the scenes to make it happen.
That could be. I mean, I know people on both sides. I can't say that. I mean, there's this whole idea of entryism, where a lot of people that are not Nazis, but are interested in the ideas of some of the people you mentioned, the traditionalists, are castigated and attacked as being Hitler worshippers or whatever, what have you, just because they have an interest in some, not all, of the ideas of Evola, Ganon, and the idea the people that attack them latch onto is that it's all kind of a fake on their part in order to lure unsuspecting young people into their fold, and then they get, you know, brainwashed and converted. I just think that that's a ludicrous argument. I don't think that's it. I mean, if there is an idea, if there is a basic battle, it's between those who have trust in life and those who fear life.
Huh. That's interesting.
That's, you know, the NRA. We're in a period where fear is being pushed all the time. We're at a time of highly evolved behavioralist propaganda. All the tricks that are used to keep people playing computer games are also being used not just to sell, you know, iPhones and such, but to sell politicians, to push people into taking certain partisan stances.
Huh.
A lot of people, I mean, I really don't think a lot of people even, I mean, I see a lot of people that I've known for some time that are just pure propaganda parrots. They don't even try to rephrase, recast things in their own words.
Huh. Well, maybe say more. That was a really interesting idea. Maybe say more about the war being between people who trust life and those who don't, those who are afraid, because that seems like it really cuts to the core of a lot of stuff right there.
Well, that's organized religion is always the looking at using fear as a tool to coax or manipulate the faithful to do what they want. And then there's the, I could say Crowley was certainly not fearful, Parsons. That is, you know, take the leap. You can trust life. That, you know, philosophies that are based on such things as synchronicity. Fear and synchronicity are opposed.
Hmm.
You know, when you're fearful, you have a narrative that everything must conform to. Synchronicity is when you open up to what's happening and life itself seems to unfold in new and unexpected ways to reflect the courage you've taken to move into different spaces. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I was just letting that sink in for a bit.
But well, here's the word. It is not necessarily magic, but one of my main influences is surrealism, which always has had, which always claimed to have a great trust in youth. And here is the battle between the NRA, which lives on fear, which makes a lot of money on fear, and students at a high school that have had enough and have had the courage to just go out and call it the way they see it. I mean, the NRA, I mean, the people that support the NRA and are always falling back on the Second Amendment don't realize that what's at stake. It's like weapons are one of the top selling items in the world.
Mm.
There are people that'll spend $1,000 a weekend shooting up refrigerators filled with gasoline and explosives with their semi-automatic weapons. The NRA is a lobbying group for gun manufacturers and bullet manufacturers. It's their job to keep people wasting their money on this shit.
Huh, interesting.
So you find these groups castigating these teenagers as fakes, as frauds, and the level of discernment in contemporary culture is so debased that people can actually swallow the idea that a student whose last name is Hogg was actually graduated from some California high school, as if in a high school consisting of thousands of people and all the thousands of their family members, not one would stand out and say, that kid doesn't go to school here.
Right.
There's no common sense in the way the narrative are interacting anymore. And it's like, it just is looking for that kind of emperor has no clothes moment. To just say,
right,
you know, this makes no sense. What you're believing, what you're putting all your energy into defending, is senseless.
Well, I really like this idea of kind of opening up versus closing down. It's definitely what I've come to learn. It's one of the main things I think I've come to learn with magic, you know, per se. It's certainly one of the things that I got from Wilhelm Reich, where Reich says, you know, there's really only two directions the energy of a human being can go, outward or within. And if you clench down, then, you know, and in fear, then you miss out on life. And if you open up and push out forward, well, then yes, you can be hurt in theory, but then you are embracing life. And the whole idea of Reichian therapy being to kind of open somebody up. I think that magic at its best does that also. Psychedelic experiences can do it. But I've definitely noticed just in my experience of occult people, you know, you can really tell who's on what page. And a lot of times people get into the occult to learn, I don't know, how to curse people or whatever. And they're always coming from that fear-based place. And, you know, and a lot of them do become gun fanatics, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of disturbing to watch. But it's something that Crowley talks about also, I think, where he talks about this kind of this idea of the Black Brotherhood in the Enochian sessions, where he has this experience of seeing the Black Brothers, who are, you know, the magicians who get to a certain level of enlightenment, but then are too afraid to let go of their individual self and then clench down and become kind of twisted and like the, I don't know, like the Sith from Star Wars or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that
makes a lot of sense.
And then he says that in order to, you know, in order to truly get to the next level, you have to let go. You have to be willing to surrender your, you know, your tiny individual ego, which is not worth a whole lot in the grand scheme of things anyways. So I think Parsons says at one point, I quoted in the book, Parsons says to Marjorie Cameron in one of his letters, he puts it really well, where he says, you know, that you bawl and weep to give up the ego, but eventually you realize that it's just like a greasy penny that you've been clutching in your hand, but that the penny was the fare to, or you know, the fee to the world's greatest fare with ice cream and candy free for everyone forever, as long as you were willing to let it go.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's, you know, it all comes, that to me is one of the key elements of magic. To me, it's always been, I'm a Terrence McKenna. I don't want to achieve some kind of Buddhist state of you know, pure immersion in the void. I think I remember hearing him say something. I like the pictures that come. I like looking at the pictures. And I'm kind of like in that frame. I like the phantasmagoria that comes when you go into deeper levels of consciousness. I'm not looking to just silence the monkey mind completely. But there's also, when you can get free of the ego, and I've done it on several occasions and often at times of great stress, there's a deeper self underneath that really has all, that really seems to have all the answers. It's kind of an amazing thing when your ego shuts up and this deeper self just stands forth and tells you just what you need to know just at that moment. I think that's something that only people that are willing to be open rather than closed can ever really interface with.
That makes sense. What were your, beautifully put. What would you say the most effective methods for, periods of stress, but.
I wouldn't recommend this one for all, but I had it happen when I was in my house and it collapsed during a hurricane. And that was 7 years ago. and I was kind of buried in rubble, and water was like rushing up, and I just reached this point. It was, you know, completely dark, and I'm like, well, this is the end of the John Graham story. That was basically my thought. And I also was, I just had lost all fear. I just accepted it. I said, there's no way out of this. So I just accepted it. And this like sense of complete peace went over me. And then this other voice came up and said, you know, you can get out of this. And it told me exactly where I was stuck, what I had to move, and how I had to get out. Then I got out, and my ego was like, we made it, and started chattering again.
Wow.
But it was, you know, but I've had it happen several times. I mean, I had a magical experience in New York years ago, Brooklyn. I lived there back in the days of pre-Giuliani, when it was, could be pretty hairy just walking around at night. And I saw this guy waiting for me with a knife. And I had to pass him to get to my apartment building. And I was like, if I turn around and run, he's just going to come after me. So I just sort of like, I'd been doing this thing with cultivating chi energy that this mime I knew had been telling me about, because I was a bike messenger. And he said, when you're really getting worn out, you can just like visualize this golden ball in the Tantian, which is the area right above the perineum. And you can just like feed on that, and it'll give you like that little extra. So I've been like playing around with that. And for some reason, I just thought of that. And I just walked up to the guy, and it was like this flash of energy just hit him. And he's like, no, no, don't hurt me. And he dropped the knife. Whoa. And ran away.
That's crazy. And then,
so when I see these gun-toting magicians, I'm like, well, you can't have much trust in your magic.
That's an incredible story.
And it's, you know, it seemed unbelievable to me. Even when I was walking up the steps, I was like, did that really just happen? But I knew it happened. You know, I looked back and I could see the knife still lying in the gutter.
Huh. That's amazing. Well, I've thought sometimes that, you know, it's like when you read these books about magic, they make it seem so formulaic, like you do X, Y, and Z, and then something will happen, like a recipe book. But yeah, I think that the two stories you just told are much closer to how I've experienced it. I mean, not those same things, obviously, but just in the sense that it seems to kind of spontaneously arise out of the moment. It makes sense in the moment. It doesn't seem strange. You don't really know where it comes from. And then afterwards, you kind of look back and go, wait, what the hell was that?
Right, exactly. I mean, I do think a lot of how my own behavior is altered by trying to stay in keeping with my intention. So I think if you're conflicted about things, or if you say you're going to do something and you don't do it, that erodes your ability to manifest intention. Because you need that, whatever, that deeper self, the subconscious, whatever it is, to fully, to know that you're fully committed to an action.
Huh.
Or to manifest. And I really don't spend a lot of time thinking about what it is, whether it's, you know, spirit or archetype or, you know, some inner mind phenomena or something that is more magical in nature. But it has to do with, if you're clear on your intention, your magic has a lot more chance of working than if you're wishy-washy.
That makes sense. I'm curious, so you started working with inner traditions in the early 90s, is that?
Yeah, it was 96.
96. And so I'm curious, I'm really curious how, having been so immersed in this stuff for so long, how you're, I guess how your attitudes about, I guess, magic, or we could say more broadly, kind of esoteric spirituality, how it's changed in the time from when you, or maybe even before you started working with inner traditions to now, because you must have gone through, I just imagine, so many manuscripts and meeting so many people and your own research and your own life. And I imagine I don't know, I couldn't stay consistent with my own views on things for that long. So I'm curious how things have changed.
I've become a lot more open-minded than I used to be. When I was looking at one tradition or one path at a time, I had a kind of knee-jerk rejection of other things. And having to deal with material coming from all these different traditions and trying to know enough about them so I can at least make a sound judgment. It's still difficult. I mean, I have my own specific beliefs, and they're just as much related to surrealism, which to my mind is a magic practice in itself. Mm-hmm. It's the act of becoming a spectator to your own thought is a trigger to certain mental phenomena that are magic in their essence, in my opinion.
What would an example be?
Well, it's the things that come out that you wouldn't otherwise see. I mean, it's having to create a state of, the French is disponibilité, but it's availability or receptiveness to things that you might even want to censor yourself. You have to, like, so you see flaws, defects in yourself, and are able to look at them unflinchingly, whereas in other state of consciousness, you're more apt to repress them, even if just on the just for the idea that they're not suitable within a certain context or whatever you're involved in at that time. But when you're actually just in that state of being a spectator to your own thought, you realize that as a human being, as a owner of consciousness, at the same time you're thinking, something is thinking you.
Hmm.
It's like the other, who you are, kind of start with a dance. Identity becomes a mutable rather than a fixed state.
That seems very similar to the kind of Vedantic the Advaita Vedanta idea of identifying with the observer of consciousness instead of identifying as consciousness, as your consciousness, you know, identifying as the part of your, whatever that part of your consciousness is, that's just a kind of a passive spectator.
Yeah, it's quite similar.
But that was something that specifically the surrealists developed as a, I guess, an aid.
Yeah, that's the psychic automatism. It's the core principle of surrealism, as in the first manifesto.
Huh. So that's what they were. That's where they started as, I guess, their source for artistic inspiration.
Right, and it's, you know, and they were never trying to create artworks as artworks. It was all things they'd found on the journey within. I mean, there's a lot of other things that went along with the writing and painting. There was like the period of sleep states that they modeled on mediums, where they would channel, Robert Deneau is channeling Marcel Duchamp, who's in New York. what was astounding about it was that he was creating the same kind of, he'd go into a trance state and just start coming out with these strange predictions, but also aphorisms that were completely like those of Duchamp.
And the paranoia critical was also from this time period.
Yeah, right? Salvador Dali was the most
That's a great one. I tried that a few times, I think. I got some pretty intense results from that.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how did you get interested in this stuff in the first place? I'm curious. Was it just an innate thing, or was it something that you were skeptical of and then researched, or was there some type of incident that turned your attention to this side of life?
It was actually kind of a slow ongoing process. As I was kind of, as I grew older, it made more and more sense. The things that I was learning through my studies of various Hermetic traditions just seemed to be ideal for pursuing the ends I wanted. You know, it was not so much as hanging on to things, keeping things, but always trying to like see what was on the next horizon. Trying to maintain a state of availability rather than cloistered in some sort of ivory tower of expertise.
Interesting. Well, that definitely gets back to what you were saying earlier about kind of trusting life, right?
Yeah, it's to me that's key, and it's you know, it's right now we're in a period where fear rules.
Yeah, that seems to be totally right. I mean, whether it's what we're talking about with the NRA, but also on the left, I mean, people are totally, I mean, I had to check out of the news cycle, you know, and I think I mentioned to you before, working on this John Dee book with you was really kind of a godsend in a way, because it took me completely out of the, you know, I would have been working, you know, writing for Vice News or something like that otherwise during the election cycle, and completely glued to the election cycle. And it's like, I've seen that, you know, just about kill people, particularly journalists.
Yeah.
You know, people can get PTSD. The crazy thing about journalists, particularly ones who cover wars and things like that, is that they get all the same stressors as people in combat, but they don't have any training to deal with it. And this goes for ones who are on the ground, but it also apparently goes for ones who are just watching this stuff on 24/7 newsfeed or Twitter. You know, they're constantly being exposed to, you know, horrifying news, and they can develop PTSD really quickly. And it seems to me that that's really, you know, a lot of people on the left just seem to be glued to, well, what's Trump saying on Twitter now? What's the latest horrific thing? And they're completely caught in a fear loop.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that's the biggest damage is this obsession with Trump is actually diverting people's attention from being able to be effective in countering what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering if, I don't know, what do you think is going to happen? What's, you know, are we going to be able to pull ourselves out of this as a culture? Are there maybe maybe there's some magical techniques that would be helpful? You know, I was just going to finish that. I was saying, you know, I like the narrative of magic because at least it's a narrative that puts people in the driver's seat, and people right now are not in the driver's seat. They're just afraid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a real fan of curse and hex magic because I think it comes back to you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not even, you know, if I was one of those who was willing to die to get rid of some figure like that, maybe it would be worth it. But I don't see that. I don't see that he represents anything so beyond the pale. I lived in New York when he was first coming up, and he was a jerk then, and he's a jerk now. But I think what people should do with magic is deal with the dysfunctional feelings that are generated by their contemplation of this. I think it's getting control over making it their own story, making it their own narrative, making it, that's where magic can come in. You can look at it as a ongoing assault 24 hours a day against your power or the power of all these people you don't know, but whose plight you empathize with. Or you can actually try to make it a positive thing as, what can I do magically to effectively counter this? What can be magically done to, you know, if it all starts, if the imaginary is what tends to become real, then start imagining things you want to become real.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think so much of the narrative has just become, you know, the Donald Trump show, including all the people who are, you know, in theory against Trump. And then we saw that in the, you know, the media, all the media I could talk about in the election was Trump, 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 Trump is so horrible. Well, I think anyone who studied NLP or anything like that will know that, you know, even if you put all this negative attention on something, you're still making it more powerful, you know, certainly to the unconscious. So,
They're feeding it, and it's actually worked for them because the media has actually profited from having this single subject eat up all the attention.
He's a great reality TV star to the end, I guess.
Yeah.
Man. Well, yeah, I don't know. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen next?
My feeling is that it's a choice between two things. He either imposes martial law and creates a kind of temporary clown fascist state, or he gets nailed for being a mobster and takes the Republican Party with him.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets reelected, to be honest, the way things are going.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I stay out of that. I mean, the people that claim to know stuff don't really know anything. You know, I see all these people speaking with such conviction about this and that, and I have no idea. And I have connections and people that would know things like that, and they're not telling me these things.
Okay. Oh, you mean in a magical sense?
Well, yeah, and also, you know, politically.
Okay.
There are people that actually have, you know, connections. And I think that when you have people that, Yeats poem about the second coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the worst are full of passionate intensity. But that's all it is. It's just passionate intensity. Yeah. And they want to believe it, so it's true.
Yeah, and the best lack all conviction.
Yeah. Well, and there you've got the Democrats and the Republicans.
Man. Well, I guess
to get involved with that on that level is ultimately counterproductive. You know, you can't. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that people are not engaged enough in the political process, and they want people like Trump for people like whoever to do what they want for them.
Mm.
But that's, you know, that's a fool's dream.
Mm.
You can't expect politicians to do anything that doesn't benefit their own needs. And to think of them as being some sort of special human being that is doing it all for the good of the country, it's ludicrous.
Hmm. Well, here's maybe a more productive question, which is, what do you think people should be focusing on, or where we should be directing our energies in whatever you want to call it, you know, the counterculture, the underground, or the occulture, as Carl Abramson says, and Jen said, because, you know, of course we were talking about at the beginning of this call, we just lost Adam Parfrey, very sadly. So, you know, we've lost another leader in the counterculture or occult world or whatever we want to call it. And I'm curious what you think kind of the way forward is. You know, I spent a lot of time kind of trying to get people unified a little bit, and that really hasn't worked that well, because people, anarchists, like to stick apart. But I don't know. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, or particularly in our current climate.
Well, one of the things that I've seen, and actually Alain de Benoist has also written to this in French, is that when you get to the extreme left and the extreme right, there's a lot of similarities between them. There's certain principal differences that they focus on, but when it comes to alternative health, alternative medicine, individual rights, things like that, things that I think are important, they see eye to eye. The extreme right and the extreme left are both environmentally conscious, which is totally attacked by both sides on behalf of the neoliberal world order. That's actually pulling the strings now. I've said it repeatedly to people that this left and right is an imaginary solution. Mm. Life is elsewhere. It's, you know, the left and the right comes from the French Revolution. The people that sat on the left at the convention wanted to have veto power over the king. The people that sat on the right thought that was an assault against divine right. And it wasn't until Dreyfus that the left got identified with the working class movement. Before then, the working class movement had steadfastly steered its own course. It was during the Dreyfus trial that socialist left made common cause with a number of working class parties. But that only lasted until the 80s. Now it's a Punch and Judy show. The areas of the left that are the easiest to caricature are seized on by the right. The areas of the right that are easiest to caricature are seized on by the left. And they battle each other, but the people pulling the strings are the bankers, the ones that are at the EU that say representative government has no legitimacy when it comes to EU decisions.
Hmm.
France never wanted to be part of the EU. When they did a referendum, they just ignored it. The French didn't want to be part of it, mainly because it's a constant struggle to maintain local sovereignty. It's to maintain, it's a constant battle to keep poisoned American foods out of Europe. They're working day and night. Big Ag in America is working day and night to force the Europeans to buy, you know, our chickens marinated in ammonia, our fruits and vegetables that are coated with pesticides that have been banned for decades in Europe because they are known carcinogens and serious toxins. And the Punch and Judy show of the left versus the right distracts from all that. That's what, to me, it's to me, the basic thing is keeping the planet viable.
Yeah, I can 100% agree with that.
And I don't care who, there are people that consider themselves right wing, there are people that consider themselves left wing, but environmentally, they're on the same page. And the real enemy to me is that amorphous, undefined elite that plays this like a puppet show to keep people from seeing where the real damage is coming from.
Right.
And yeah, there's areas that I disagree with vehemently, with people on either side of the political equation. But then there are things that I feel we can work together. And it's a way, if you can find a way to do that without letting ideology determine your actions, then I think there's a chance that the planet can survive.
Well, we might not have a whole lot of time left to do
No. But ideology is it's this purist thing really started with Protestantism. Catholicism was a extremely, its whole strategy was to absorb and reframe pagan structures into their organization. The real witch killing didn't get started until the Protestants. And the Calvinists, the more extreme ideologues, and that their way of proceeding appears again in Stalinist communism or Hitlerian fascism. It's just this idea of purity.
Interesting. Well, I know René Guénon really, really pointed the finger at Protestantism as the trigger for the degeneration of all, traditional initiated wisdom in Europe.
Oh yeah, well, there's Jean Markel, who is a leftist and a writer on things Celtic, was firmly convinced that Roman Catholicism had lost its magic when they stopped doing the mass in Latin, that the priest had his back to the congregation.
Was that Vatican II or prior to that?
I think it was prior to Vatican II.
Interesting. Well,
John Markel wrote a Marxist Life of Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Okay. Well, that's a lot to have on our plate here going forward. I guess we should probably wrap up because we're at an hour. We could probably keep talking about a tremendous range of subjects. But I'm curious if people want to find out more about you or where they should go, or if you want to mention projects that are coming up from Inner Traditions that people would be interested in.
We have a lot of things coming out. Speaking of Evola, we're doing volume 2 of Intro to Magic, which isn't Evola as much as the Ur group, which includes Kremertz and a number of other, Gustav Mehrink, a number of other occultists that he worked with. And these, the experiments that are recounted there, the texts that are in there, are, I think, importance equal to Crowley's work with the aether.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think there's some really incredible things in here. People need to remember that when Evola chose fascism, it was not because he was fascist, but that it was because he thought it was the only governmental form that in this corrupt world, it was the one that came closest to being able to restore some of the principles of a traditional society. So the political, if you're really going to attack Evelyn for being a fascist, you have to include the Catholic Church, because there was a war for Mussolini's soul between Evelyn and the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church won.
Well, that first, you know, the first Evelyn book on magic I've had forever, and that's an intense book.
Yeah, it's
that one goes deep.
Yeah, so you know, it's not. You know, it'll be attacked by some people as catering to fascists, but it's really it's an important book.
What is the Aethers part?
I was just going to say there was another book by this woman Julia Morley on natural intelligence. I highly recommend, but it's experiments there with in the ERV group, accessing areas of higher spiritual consciousness,
but not with Enochian specifically. Just something similar.
Similar. It's like Mithraic techniques or things they found in Vedanta.
Huh. And you've got that Stephen Flowers book coming out on the Fraternitas Saturni also?
Yeah, that just came out.
Oh, okay.
It's one that he'd published some years ago with his Rune of Raven Press, but now it's been substantially revised and expanded. So it's basically a new book.
Awesome. And you've got Mitch Horowitz's new book coming out?
The Miracle Club. That's a great book. That is absolutely. I think he goes places in the Miracle Club that he didn't go in some of the books he published earlier.
Hmm.
There's some really wild, wild stuff in this book. It's really a revelation. Plus, he's so totally convincing. I mean, I think he's a real magic worker.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw him. So I just saw him speak last week in LA. And he's quite charismatic. And he really gets to the core of things.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, this is, that's it. I think people find that book very interesting.
Awesome. And then I guess innertraditions.com is the place to find stuff?
Yeah, that we have all our books that are out and have been announced on our website. There's a lot more coming that I haven't, I'm still waiting for manuscripts on, so I can't really speak to them, but there's some pretty interesting things in the pipeline.
Awesome. All right. Well, John, thank you very much thank you very much for speaking. And hopefully we'll catch up again very soon.
Great. Well, it's nice to talk with you as always, Jason.
All right. Thanks, John.
Again soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.